On this call tonight, we're discussing the spread, the causes, the diagnosis and the control or management of facial eczema. If you're listening in the South Island or even parts of the North Island, you may not feel that FE is a threat to your sheep, your beef cattle, your dairy cows or your deer. But for some time now, the extent and the threat of facial eczema has been predicted to increase. And for those of you who can remember not that long ago to the summer of 2015-2016, we saw some of the highest and most widespread FE levels seen, and certainly the spore counts that Beef and Lamb New Zealand were advertising each week in our e-diary were off the charts, literally. And if you've seen recently, this year's lamb crop and farmers' bottom line are showing some evidence of the impact on stock health, stock productivity and ultimately profit. Now within Dairy NZ, Dairy Industry New Zealand and Beef and Lamb New Zealand and our respective industries, more and more effort is being directed or being certainly considered at the moment towards avoiding, remedying or mitigating the impacts of the disease. And so tonight we're going to discuss the biology of facial eczema itself, the impacts of the toxin on animals. We'll talk about what's happening with farmers or for farmers to help them deal with it. And so for a change tonight, we've actually got two guests, Robert Carter, who chairs the Facial Eczema Working Group, and Dr. Neil Towers, who's had a lifetime of working with facial eczema. So welcome to the call, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We'll get underway. Robert, might just start with you, just the usual introductions. What's your background? Where do you farm? And why are you involved in this issue? And what's your experience with it?
Well, thanks, Aaron. My wife, Suzanne, and I farm southwest of Taumaru Nui. We've got a 300-hectare hill country block down there. And facial eczema visited us in a bad way originally back in 1992. We'd had a recorded Cootworth flock for a long time prior to that. And I'd crossbred them with Texels, which gave a good lift in meat production. But at that stage, I hadn't realised that Texels weren't quite so good as far as FE tolerance was concerned. Although I love the sheep, the Texel, we really were caned. We lost about 130 out of 400 ewe hoggets that year, and I decided then that I had to do something about it. So I did my research and I decided, or we decided, that breeding tolerance into the animals was the way to go. And that started my journey into understanding FE, or facial eczema. And I guess because I was the sort of farmer who asked a lot of questions, I ended up on what is now Beef and Lamb New Zealand's Farmer Council, or previous iterations of that organisation. And being based in the King Country in the northern half of the North Island, it would be fair to say that FE's always been a focus. So morphing forward to now, with my involvement with the FE working group, I realised even before we had that last bad outbreak over the last season that we had dropped the ball as far as FE education and research had gone. I became aware that we were losing capability in terms of research, and I decided that we should get together and try and do something about that. So I called up the soldiers, so to speak, and Beef and Lamb came to the party and funded a forum, which we held about a year ago, I think it was, almost to the date. And we invited everybody that had anything to do with facial eczema to the forum, and we had it properly facilitated. And out of that, we realised that there were certainly a lot of needs that weren't being met in terms of the disease and its knowledge about it, and also the education, which is ongoing for farm operators. So to date, we've ended up in a steadily better place. We now have a group which is officially known as the Facial Eczema Research and Education Group, but it's been shortened to just being called the FE Working Group. We have a coordinator in Dr. Ken Genty, and Ken's been pulling all the various parts of it together, and of very recent times, working alongside Aaron Meikle, the working group has pulled in Beef and Lamb New Zealand, Dairy New Zealand, Dairy Industry New Zealand, into forming a strategy that's going to be ongoing. That's our job of work as we speak. It's multi-species, the FE problem, and it just made absolute sense to me for us to work together collaboratively and determine what the research and education needs are going forward. So that's a brief introduction and a very brief history of where we've got to date, Aaron.
Great, thanks Robert. And Neil, so same sort of thing. You want to give us the potted history? Sort of, I actually referred to you, I think, in some of the PR as a former ag research scientist, but I didn't realise it was quite as former as you were telling me, 13 years or so since you worked there. But your sort of history, your background, research areas, and why you've been working in this field with EV?
I joined what was then the Department of Agriculture as a student in 1963. And in one way or another have worked in the field of facial eczema ever since. So I've been at the Ruakura Research Centre. I joined there very soon after the cause of facial eczema was discovered, the toxin was identified, and at about the time that the effective fungicides were discovered. I was responsible for finding out that zinc would protect against facial eczema and for developing the techniques for testing rams for their ability to withstand facial eczema. So I've been involved in facial eczema research for a lifetime, basically.
All right. So a number of those things we're going to expand on later on, but look, start with the big picture stuff, I guess, which is the big picture. If you look at a map of New Zealand, there's been a distribution of facial eczema and where we see impacts on stock. The forecast for that is to increase quite markedly. Do you want to just explain why we're expecting it's going to get worse and, as best you can, where we think, you know, peat farmers need to start preparing for this to arrive on their farm?
Well, the first thing to understand is facial eczema is caused by a fungus called Pithomyces chartarum, which produces spores in the pasture. It grows on the dead litter at the base of the pasture. And to grow well, it needs temperatures of about 20 degrees and humidity of about 100%. So it's only in those times and areas where you can get those conditions. And in the past, that has been most of the lower-lying areas of the North Island, particularly when there's been a drought followed by rain, because the fungus actually grows on the dead litter that's in the base of the pasture. So with global warming, of course, the areas which meet those conditions is going to move further south and to higher altitudes. In the past, it's been thought that it was unlikely to get facial eczema above 300 metres, mainly because it's cooler and often drier. Well, with the change in climate, the altitudes will rise and the distribution will move south. It may be that some of the problems of Northland, if it gets drier, may be lessened, but generally the area is going to expand.
So when you say, and we were talking about this before the call, when you say it moves, well, the problem moves, is that the Pithomyces already there? Do we know that? Or is it actually, it's going to move itself? Or if you're a farmer in Otago, do you have the fungal already, but it's just not the right conditions for it to cause a problem?
What do you know about it? I'd have to say I don't know the answer to that. We do know that facial eczema is in the past has actually occurred as far south as Geraldine. Mm-hmm. And certainly it's occurred in the northern parts of the South Island and the West Coast. Not every year, in fact, quite rarely. But if the conditions on that particular year meet the requirements, there have been facial eczema outbreaks. The very fact that there's been at least one outbreak as far south as Geraldine probably says that the fungus is about. Mm. So if we get the right conditions, then it's highly likely that it'll be there.
So just on those right conditions, last year was, you know, seen as a really bad year. What was it, temperature, humidity? What were the factors that made last year so bad, and given people think it's going to be at least as bad in future?
Temperature And humidity and moisture are the major issues. As I said, it's growing on the dead litter at the base of the pasture, and it needs to be moist, and it needs to be warm. So if you get those conditions, and those are the times when we get warm, humid air masses move down from the tropics, those are classical. Some of the very worst years are actually being associated with La Nina, but that's not to say that there have been, haven't been facial eczema in other years as well.
And just out of interest, I see the other day they've declared we're heading into another La Nina this summer, so I understand.
In that case, be concerned.
So, and this is not directly relevant to New Zealand sheep and beef farmers or dairy farmers or deer farmers, but another interesting thing about it, those conditions exist in other countries, for example, in Australia, but the Pithomyces, there's a number of different species, and some of them actually don't produce the toxin, is it?
That's true. For reasons unknown, nearly all New Zealand isolates of the Pithomyces produce toxin. In some other countries, it's a minority of isolates. Australia, from memory, is probably about 50-50. Some other countries, you know, they vary across the range. But New Zealand, 95% or so of all isolates produce toxin. So we're in the gun.
Bad luck or whatever, it's ended up that way. So, all right, you talk about it growing on the dead litter. So one of the things, and we'll remind people about this at the end of the call and in a follow-up email, we've just revised the Facing Up to Facial Eczema book that Beef and Lamb New Zealand produced with the helps of these two gentlemen and a number of others. And one of the sections in that is around different pastures and different forages and which are higher risk and lower risk. So partly it's the dead matter. Can you maybe expand a wee bit on which plant species or grass species are lower risk and why? Is it just because they have lower dead matter, or is there some other inherent factors about those plants that don't lead to the problem?
It's almost certainly just the amount of dead matter in the base of the pasture. Ryegrass pastures are amongst the worst. Fescue pastures, so long as they're clean, much less dangerous. Crops which have low litter, brassicas, chicory, they have much less, can be very safe. Pure clover swards can have very low counts. Some of the less fertile grasses you get in hill country tend to have lower counts. So it's mainly how the pasture sward is structured, the amount of dead litter there, and whether it's of a structure that helps keep the temperature up and the moisture, there.
And allied to that, Neil, could you perhaps comment on grazing management, perhaps not going down to very low residuals when you've got dead and dying leaf litter?
Grazing pressure is quite a determinant of how severe a facial eczema will be. Most of the spores are in the base of the pasture. So if you cut in layers, that's where you find most of the spores, and as you go up the leaf height, fewer and fewer. So during an outbreak, grazing laxly, moving the animals around quickly, grazing them on areas which tend to be drier, colder, will all help reduce risk.
Can it be, can grazing management, just to expand on what Robert was asking, can it be preventive? Can you graze your pastures to avoid, if you try and graze to avoid the amount of dead matter, can you lower your risk of high spore counts?
The lower the dead matter content, you know, obviously the lower the substrate for the fungus to grow, the lower the spore count potential is, but generally, particularly in ryegrass pastures, which are across so much of New Zealand's pasture land, there's nearly always enough litter there for a toxic crop to grow. You can make it worse, you know, don't top, for instance, just before facial expert season. You know, so bad grazing management can make it worse.
What about, this is a personal interest, living on the east coast of the South Island, you mentioned a number of species. What about lucerne? And grazing lucerne tends to leave a reasonable amount of dead matter behind by design. Is that any idea on the risk of facial expert on lucerne?
I have to say, in 40 years, I don't know I've ever heard of grazing lucerne as a in terms of facial eczema. I think it will depend very much on how the grazing hind. If you keep up above that dead litter, then I think, you know, your risks will be lowered.
Would you have the same damp, high temp conditions replicated in a standard lucerne?
True.
I'd argue possibly not.
Maybe not yet.
Yeah, not yet, but maybe it could happen.
Hmm. What so about
something to monitor, I would suggest.
Yeah, no, it's look, I'm coming at this from a very naive background, because where I come from, we don't think we've had it, and I'm south from Geraldine as well, so, but it's coming by the sounds of it. One of the other, you know, when we talk about species and so on, but we've also had, you know, major breeding efforts or selection efforts in ryegrass endophyte for protection against Argentine stem weevil and various other pests, but trying to minimise the animal impacts. Is there any possibility in terms of selection or breeding within ryegrasses with endophytes or anything like that to reduce their facial eczema risk?
A little outside my field of expertise, but I think one of the factors that ryegrass litter persists and is there for the fungus to grow on is its sort of fibrous nature. So I guess the corollary might be that if you bred for a lower fibre content, something which rotted away quicker, then you may be able to reduce the number of spores there.
Okay. But I guess that's part of what we were talking about originally, Aaron. There are things that we need to research, and perhaps that's just one of those avenues that we should be following up with the R&D.
Yeah. And that's part of, you know, tonight, why it's interesting to see the questions we get in from the community as well. What are people wondering about? And that helps guide us in some of the investment decisions we might make in research or development.
That's right.
Okay, so let's move on and talk about the animals now that are on these pastures and so on. Neil, you touched on it a wee bit, or Robert, you can probably touch on this as well. What is the issue? I mean, we talk about liver damage, and obviously it's facial eczema, so it causes the eczema on the face. What's happening in the animal? Why are we getting those symptoms and impacts on the animal's health?
Well, the disease is actually an intoxication, and the name facial eczema is almost a misnomer. What's actually happening is that the sporidesmin is very toxic to cells, and it's taken in when the animal eats, taken up into the liver, and there it causes damage, particularly to the bile ducts. And then the bile ducts swell, get edema, and can block off completely. And then at that stage, the animal can no longer excrete a lot of the byproducts of chlorophyll in the glass and grass, which normally get excreted in the bile and into the feces. And so that spills back into the bloodstream, and there's a particular chemical known as phylloerythrin, which is the breakdown product of chlorophyll, which is photodynamic. It absorbs light energy and then re-emits it in such a way that it starts to cause cell death, cell damage. And so that's why you see some of the clinical signs in the exposed area on the animal, because it's on the face, the muzzle, the ears, the udder, the escutcheon, where the blood supply is fairly close to the surface. It's not protected by wool or hair to the same extent. And so you get this photosensitization. You see it as the animals start to seek shade, reddening of the tissue. They rub themselves against fences and gates and trees and cause damage, and then you get visible signs. But most of the problem is because of damage to the function of the liver.
So when you talk about clinical versus subclinical, clinical is obviously what you can see, the facial damage. The damage to the liver, is that what you're calling subclinical damage?
That's subclinical damage.
Yep.
It's only seen if you slaughter the animal and examine the liver,
okay.
or if you take blood samples and do an analysis for what we call GGT. It's an enzyme released from the damaged bile ducts.
Okay.
So the issue is that even with animals that are affected that are not showing any external signs, the ones that we call clinical cases, even subclinical, where there are no external signs, no drooping ears, no reddening, they look quite fine. There's still a depression in production, and that's how that can affect us. Farmers may not even be aware that they've got an issue until they realise that they've got a depressed scanning percentage in ewes, for example. So it really comes down to it severely reduces production across those species that we're discussing.
So let's talk a bit more about that. If you're starting to see clinical signs, the facial eczema, the photosensitivity, and we were, again, talking a wee bit this about before, and I know it's difficult to be absolutely precise, but there's some rough estimates. If you're seeing 1%, 5% of your sheep flock with clinical facial eczema, how big is the iceberg under the water, effectively? Can you estimate or big picture, say, roughly this many are likely to have subclinical damage?
Well, for example, in one of the trials, we had 275 ewes. Mm-hmm. Three were found to have clinical facial eczema, but it was very mild, and it was only because the animals were looked at every week as part of the trial. 45% of the animals had elevated GGTs, which meant there was some level of liver damage.
Mm-hmm.
And in that flock, they were scanned, the lambing percentage dropped 8%.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very mild outbreak.
Yeah, with a single-figure percentage.
A single-figure percentage. Rough figure, if you go up into a few higher percentages, say 5% clinical, you'll have more than 50% liver damage, probably getting up to 60-70%.
So in some of the areas that are hot for facial, in a lot of years you could have no clinical facial eczema, but you would still expect you might have a significant proportion of the flock, the herd, with subclinical impacts on production.
Yes, very definitely.
Endemic's not necessarily the word, but it's an ongoing problem that people don't recognise except in worst years, possibly.
It's a hidden problem because mostly there's no outs external signs. And, for instance, there are lots of other things which people would put it down to.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if you dose lactating dairy cows with very low levels of the toxin, you get no measurable liver damage.
Mm-hmm.
You get a drop in milk yield.
Okay.
So, and that's in autumn. There are lots of reasons for drops in milk yield in autumn amongst dairy cows. If you give them a bit more, you get changes in milk composition which look exactly like mastitis and elevated somatic cell counts.
Mm-hmm.
So,
trying to get a handle on the size of the problem. So, that's the impact, the scale of the problem. What's the monitoring? What can people do to try and... We're going to talk about management decisions and longer-term breeding decisions shortly, but if you're a farmer on a deer farm, a dairy farm, a sheep and beef farm, what's the monitoring of either animals, pastures, spore counts that you can do? What's the recommended tools?
Well, in one sense, one of the few good things about Pithomyces is the spore is actually quite easily recognised.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a very distinctive shape. It's often described as looking like a hand grenade. So it is quite easily recognised. So it is quite easy, but tedious, to collect pasture samples, even fecal samples, and do what we call a wash count, dilute them, wash the spores off the grass, put them under a microscope and count them. And so you can monitor when they are starting to appear, how fast they're growing. So monitoring is key.
Mm.
You get some idea from watching the weather patterns, of course, because it's not going to happen in the middle of a drought. The end of the drought, when it rains, it probably will happen. Mm-hmm. So monitoring is the key.
Yep. And various agencies are providing that monitoring already, so my advice would be to watch that count that the agency is providing for your district, and then start to think about taking action before the spore counts go too high, rather than waiting till you've got a severe problem before you start to take some action.
So is there a rule of thumb for when spore counts are too high, or...?
Well, we've had a big discussion about this recently, haven't we, Neil? And it was very difficult to get to a definitive level of spore counts that where we would start to look at each other and be very worried. But the consensus was if they start to rise and you've got those weather conditions prevailing where the temperature's coming up and the humidity's coming up, be concerned about it. Okay.
And again, we're going to get a wee bit more into what you can do when that happens, but at the moment... We publish them in Beef and Lamb New Zealand's eDiary every week. They're on the website, on a Sure Qualities website, the monitoring each week. Is that a good enough monitoring, or do you think people should be doing their own, you know, farm-specific monitoring, or is the area monitoring good enough?
Like a lot of answers, it depends. Now, it depends on where you are and what your past history is and what the weather's looking like. You must remember, a district average is an average. By definition, that means that about half the spore counts will be lower and half will be higher. And so for some farmers in a district, if you're relying just on a district average, it's too late. You may be in that top percentage where it's, the counts are already high. So watching district monitoring early in the season, particularly when the weather isn't really too threatening, okay. As soon as the weather starts to look more threatening and the spore count rises in your district, then the best thing for an individual is to start monitoring or his own property, and particularly the areas where he might be grazing or thinking of grazing his stock.
So even though weather, climate, humidity, etc. are pretty close between neighbouring farms, the things you touched on before around species, grazing management, amount of dead matter, can be different enough between two neighbouring farms to have significant differences in spore counts. Well,
even I'd suggest on a farm too, because the way I look at it, Neil, and correct me if I'm wrong, I've always viewed it as a microclimate thing. So there'll be areas within an individual farm which will have high spore counts and areas on the same farm which may be comparatively safe.
Same occurs within a paddock. Areas near a hedge, sheltered from a drying wind, higher spore counts than across the paddock in a drying wind. So there are big variations even across a paddock, and certainly from paddock to paddock.
So you're encouraging people to do their own, and I mean, this sounds very similar to what we talked about last month with soil testing. You would encourage individuals to do blocks within their farm to get an idea of the range within their
The more you know about what's happening on your farm this year and in past years, the better you're prepared.
Okay. So, and just to be more specific about you talked about the wash test, but how do you do that? Do you do your own, or are you sending them off to a lab and getting the results back?
These days, most of them would be done by veterinary practices on the whole. And that's a case of the farmer taking the samples and curing them to the local vet lab, who will then return. But the technique is actually very, very simple. It all requires is a reasonably good microscope, a particular slide which is called a hemocytometer, and that's about it. And it's simply just a matter of taking a set amount of grass, mixing it with 10 times the weight of water, giving it a good shake, then putting an eyedropper full on the slide and looking at it. Many years ago, when I first came into FE research, it was the time when Margaret de Menna was teaching farmers, or mainly it was farmers, how wives to do the counts. And there used to be several hundred farmers doing their own spore counts.
Timing. So we talked about some of the conditions and the ongoing monitoring, and this is actually something we've been talking about on the working group, Robert, around traditionally the area monitoring, the published stuff starts in beginning of January. This year we're actually going to start a bit of a not an experiment as such, just a trial, do some in the coming 6 weeks up till Christmas to see what things are like. What's your expectation? You know, are we, with the way things are changing, are we seeing spore counts climbing earlier in the year than we historically have expected to see them?
Well, I'd have to say I haven't actually seen any evidence to suggest that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
The spore counts in those graphs that come out, you know, they're rising at about the same time most years. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of variation, obviously, because there are variations in the rainfall and the temperatures from year to year. My prediction for your work, that you will find very low, almost nil counts from now till December.
Good. And we're recording this, so we'll hold you to it.
You can hold me to it.
So that,
then come actually, back and tell me if I'm wrong, because someone else might ask me the same question.
So that actually does raise an interesting point, though. So, you know, you talk about the climate change and how we've seen it move higher and further south, but you don't think that climate change will see it coming earlier in the year?
Oh, if the climate change actually brings the temperature and the moisture forward, mm-hmm. yes, you will see it earlier.
Okay, but at the moment you don't think we
I don't know that, well, we haven't really moved far enough along that warming to actually bring that forward, I don't think, yet.
We're enjoying what you might call cool but moist conditions at the moment. Not particularly warm, even here in Hamilton.
Yeah, well, normally when I'm up here, I say, can you send some of your rain south? But this year, I think we're one of the dampest springs in 30-odd years in places, so we're doing all right at the moment. On spore counting, then, one thing that comes up from time to time, you've talked about the pasture method, and others talk about the fecal spore counts, just like we can do fecal egg counts, you can do spore counts in faeces. Any comments on that method? Is it better, worse, more accurate? Complements, replaces? What's its role?
It's a complement, I think, mm-hmm. rather than a replacement. To actually work out the amount of toxin the animals are getting, you have to know three things. How many spores, how many they're actually eating, and so for that you need to know the total amount of grass. For instance, if we're looking at a grass spore count, we can measure the number of spores per gram of grass. What we don't know is how many grams of grass the animal eats, and whether what it's actually selecting is actually what we've measured. So we can measure two out of the three things you need to know. And it's the same with the fecal count.
Mm-hmm.
We can measure the spores per gram of faeces. We don't know how many faeces they voided, so you can't work out the total amount of toxin.
Mm-hmm.
So neither of them tell you all of the picture. What they do tell you is that there are spores about and there is risk.
Mm-hmm.
The pasture count can identify the risk before the animals are exposed. So, you know, if you want to go around and count every pasture on your farm, you can identify the safest and put your animals there if you want to do that amount of work. The downside of that, it's a lot of work, a lot of sampling. Fecal sampling is easier, you just pick up a few feces. The downside is that you can't do the count until the spores have passed through the animals. So it happened to be a toxic pasture. The only time you know that is about 3 days, 2 to 3 days after the animals have eaten the spores.
Mm.
So early in the season, fecal count would be quite appropriate as a monitor just to determine, are there spores around?
Mm-hmm.
Are they rising? But as soon as they start to rise, then I would think wash counts for the pasture are a much better way to go, because that can identify there is a real risk, particularly if you're grazing hard.
Okay, so you've listened to this sort of stuff, you understand the biology, what the issue is with you're doing the monitoring that we've just talked about, you start to see a lift. What do you do? What are your suggestions? What can people do to avoid, remedy, mitigate the impact that's coming from the rise in spore counts?
The only options that people have at the moment are, well, I suppose, feed substitution,
mm-hmm.
put them on crops, feed out your winter silage. So feed substitution,
mm-hmm.
Or zinc prophylaxis.
Mm-hmm.
Dosing with zinc oxide has been shown to reduce the amount of toxic, or the damage that the toxin does. You have to have the zinc there at the time the toxin
mm-hmm.
is taken in, because it's protecting by binding to the toxin. Zinc binds to the toxin
mm-hmm.
and stops it entering a cyclic reaction which causes cell damage. So you've got to have the zinc there at that time. Giving zinc after has no good mm-hmm. effect at all, and in fact giving it weeks before has no effect either, because
mm-hmm.
it's that timing issue. And currently at the moment, those are the only two things that can be done. You can try and there's one other, which if you do earlier, and that's to spray pastures with fungicides. Mm-hmm. There's one particular class of fungicide, and only one class of fungicide, which will prevent the spores that are there germinating and growing a new set of mycelians, and reduce the number of spores multiplying.
So I'm coming back to zinc, because there's been a few questions about that, but just while we're on the fungicide, what's the class of fungicides, and it's, how effective are they, how cost-effective are they?
It's the benzimidazoles,
mm-hmm.
so...
the white drenches.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the very first work was actually done with thibenzole drench.
Mm-hmm.
By...
spraying it and diluted onto pastures.
Yeah. I was a farm manager on the Manatuki Research mm-hmm. Farm who saw that it was effective against some fungi
mm-hmm.
And decided he would try do a trial on... on the farm for FE. So Benlate is one, Mitac, I don't know them all off by name, but it's that one class of fungicides, so quite a number of them in a group.
And they work?
They do. The trial work that Jack Powell and Margaret Amena did many years ago, depending on dose rates, it would reduce the rises in spore numbers somewhere between 55% and 65%.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue is you have to put them on well, you have to put them on before the spore counts get to toxic levels. It doesn't actually kill the fungus, mm-hmm. it's just stopping the germination and the new generations.
Mm-hmm.
So works if you do it properly, but you do have to spray all areas the animals are going to graze, and it can be expensive.
Mm. You got any comments, Robert? Is it cost effective?
Well, I guess it is if it saves your animals, but I think long term, I don't think it's sustainable for a number of reasons, mainly being the cost and ensuring that it's effective, because how often do you have to do it, for example, and how long can you sustain the cost benefit of that method?
So in trial work, the spore counts have been held down for generally about 4 or 5 weeks, 6 weeks at the most.
Mm-hmm.
So in a very severe year, you would have to respray every 4 weeks.
Mm. So the other method then you talked about using zinc as a prophylaxis, and there's two methods, bolus or in drinking water.
In trial work, drinking water can be very effective, but it's also been shown to be very variable in how well it's been applied on the farm. There is survey work which shows that it's is very variable.
Mm-hmm.
So the other option is drenching or mm-hmm. bolus. In dairy cattle, of course, it's quite possible to drench daily. Later in the, well, earlier they've probably been drenching for magnesium and anyway. So drenching is quite an option in those circumstances.
Because it needs to be done that frequently, daily?
Best protection is daily.
Yeah.
You can get some protection dosing every second or third day,
mm-hmm.
or even weekly. And we did actually do some trial work with sheep where we got some protection dosing fortnightly,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't particularly good. You know, you could see that it was having an effect, but wasn't really worth that. So it's really got to be daily or best every second day. And if you... So, and the other option are the boluses.
Mm-hmm. So what specific question and a couple of questions on this, and we were discussing it, we had a good discussion before this call. What's the sustainability of using zinc? It's a heavy metal. The question we had come in is any environmental implications from basically animals having that in their feces from zinc bolus or the other methods?
Well, I guess it has to be a matter of concern. It will, with time, build up.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's an issue that needs to be looked at. It hasn't, as far as I know, been examined
mm-hmm.
in any research way. So I guess that's an issue that has to be resolved.
Well,
and it does have implications, of course, for long-term usage.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the discussions we've had in the FE working group is certainly the issue of a non-tariff trade barrier.
Mm-hmm.
Heavy metal, zinc's a heavy metal, and there has been concern expressed that long-term use could come back to bite us
mm-hmm.
because we are a food-producing nation.
Mm. Yep.
We did do some work on that very early on. Zinc dosing does not change the zinc level in tissue,
mm-hmm.
Muscle tissue to any great extent, but it will accumulate in liver.
Mm.
So in offal organs, yes.
Yeah.
Didn't have much effect on milk levels either.
Often with these things, perceptions become reality, even if the science is not necessarily supported.
Perception is all.
Yeah.
Couple of other questions around this, you know, what you can do to manage it. And one question, do Lyme applications help? I guess either directly or indirectly through Lyme and soil conditions, lower dead matter, higher quality pastures, anything like that? Any comments on that one?
It's been looked at.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's been some claims for it. It was first looked at about 40-50 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and in that trial Lyme had no effect. In more recent well-established trials, it has no effect. You've got to remember that the toxins produced by a fungus and putting lime on it, lime is not a fungicide,
mm-hmm.
and most fungicides have no effect on this particular organism anyway. Mm-hmm. So the only way it could have any effect is changing the nature of the sward.
Mm.
More clover.
More
clover, less litter. And that would be the only way it could have an effect. So relying on lime, not at all advisable.
Perhaps, Aaron, better quality pasture, less leaf litter, and more attention to the grazing method so that you're not going down low into the residuals could be a good suggestion.
Yeah,
not the whole answer, but part of the answer.
So good practice in soil and pasture management generally will help. Another specific question on that is whether seaweed feed to stock gives any assistance. That's the question.
Difficult question to answer, but I think a lot of those methods may have some merit, but we need to actually do some really good trial work to see whether that is actually the case or whether it's falling into the realms of possibility rather than probability. But Neil might have some comments about it.
Seaweed might have zinc in it, does it?
It might have zinc, but the amount of zinc is going to be at best at the trace element level, and the amount of zinc we're giving to the animals for protection is very substantially higher. It's 10-20 times greater than their need is as a trace element. I'd have to say in my rational scientist hat I could see no benefit from giving seaweed at all. The only good thing about the seaweed mixtures many, many years ago, I found that some of them were very good at suspending zinc oxide for dosing.
Uh-huh.
And it was probably the agar method, part of the...
Yeah.
And so the recipes that we wrote used to include maxi crop.
Uh-huh.
It could be, Aaron, that it makes farmers feel better because they're trying to do something.
Mm.
Not necessarily effective, but if somebody's taking some action and they're desperate, and I can understand that desperation, you can understand people wanting to have a go.
Which is what we're
but
about
for
to
me,
know.
I need to have proof that it actually works.
And it may, I don't know, and I can't remember where the question came from, but possibly it was something to do with what you talked about there, that you had actually used the likes of MaxiCrop and seaweed extracts.
Yeah, it was actually because it allowed you to support suspend more zinc oxide in a smaller volume of liquid,
mm-hmm.
and also stabilised it so that it would actually sit there as a stable suspension. Now, I'm sure, you know, if you went to a pharmaceutical company, they would come up with something that would do the job, and but
you need to experience actually trying to drench animals with a zinc suspension through a drench gun. It brings out the best and the worst in people.
The idea that it would work actually came from a farmer somewhere down near Gisborne.
Mm-hmm.
And
all right, so we've talked about some monitoring, some shorter term stuff, but let's move on to the longer term options. And look, from what I can see, this is one that offers probably some of the greatest hope for sheep, cattle, deer, which is genetic tolerance to phagetics for now. Just want to be clear, I didn't get my knuckles slapped, but I certainly got this explained to me in no uncertain terms. We're talking tolerance, not resistance.
Yeah. Because it is a toxin. If you give any animal enough of it, it will be affected by it. So hence the difference between tolerance and resistance.
They can handle it at a certain level, but even very tolerant animals eventually could be.
Yeah, for example.
All right.
Yeah.
So Neil, this is something I know you've been involved in, and Robert, I know this is one of your... Tell us about the current Rangar, the FE Gold process, what it involves, what... how it works, the opportunities that are there, and why farmers in affected areas should be using it.
Well, essentially it's a performance test for potential size. And the technique is really very simple. The potential size are usually selected because of their other performance trait, are dosed with a known amount of sporidesmin, the toxin that causes facial eczema, and a blood sample is taken at that time to see what their normal GGT level is, and then 3 weeks later another sample is taken to see whether they've suffered any liver damage. Now, the amount of GGT that appears in the blood is very closely related to the severity of the liver damage. And so if you get a very large rise in GGT values, then obviously it's suffered significant liver damage and is sensitive to facial eczema. And so the system, which has been in place since 1982, the first commercial testing was done, has been to test the rams and then use those few which have not reacted to the dosing. And so that's been going on since, as I said, since 1982. Quite a lot of those original breeders are still, or their sons these days, their sons are now still in the breeding game. Mm. And so they have had flocks which have been under test for 30-something years. The amount of toxin given has just gradually crept up if they're doing the breeding program correctly, if they're selecting, testing enough animals and only using the best.
And it's relatively highly heritable as a trait?
It's a very highly heritable trait. Its heritability, 0.4 4.2, which, as I'm given to understand, is about the highest heritability going.
So, and the breeders, though, with that high heritability, do breeders need to keep on testing? Because once they've established the lines that have got a high tolerance, and
there was a pair of flocks set up at Ruakura just to try and look at that, and at the time that work was discontinued a few years ago, the lines were still diverging. So I guess the question is, until the breeders stop seeing any advance, then I guess the answer is they should keep selecting.
I think one of the important things that I'd like to mention at this juncture, Aaron, is that the industry flocks, you know, which are basically a set of research flocks that farmers have provided data from the progeny testing using the Sporidesmin testing, though that data that comes out into Sheep Improvement Limited database, that's used to validate genomic tools, which I think is a very important thing in terms of being able to have another set of tools in the toolkit. So we need to do more progeny testing so that we've got more data to add more weight to the validation of those genomic tools. But of course, the genomic tools only work when the animals in the cohort are actually related to the flock from which the progeny testing is done. But it's still a good tool. One of the downsides of the progeny testing is the sheer cost of it. It's, roundly speaking, it's about $400 per ram that a breeder will pay to get it completely assessed. And one of our aims is to try and do some more research into reducing that cost so that we can drive the number of progeny tests done in cohorts of sheep upwards, thus providing more robust data sets for the validation. So to answer your original question, it's really important that farmers carry on doing the testing. And I think you could say that the industry standard that they've kind of arrived at is around about 0.6 milligrams per kilogram live weight of the animal. But I have heard of breeders where they haven't been getting a reaction at that level, they've actually raised that level a little bit higher, 0.62, 0.65 I've heard of. And that is to try and test those animals enough, because you need to find at what level you're getting to actually get a solid selection, because it's not actually that useful if they all pass. You actually want to test them to a level where you've got a few failures so that you know that you're actually putting selection pressure on the cohort.
So 0.6, that's the Sporidesmin dosage you're talking about there. And you'd expect that with that heritability and 30 years of selection, you would expect that tolerance to have lifted dramatically.
Well, I think it's a story that the likes of Neil and the sheep industry should give themselves a big pat on the back, because it has been a great success story, and the breeders that have been involved in that right from the early days really do deserve accolades for deciding that the long-term benefit was worth the pain. And it's, from my perspective as a commercial farmer with a small recorded flock, it makes your farming life so much easier having tolerant animals, because you go into a season like we've just had and there are very, very few clinicals, and your lambing percentage is staying up where it should be. So to me, it's a no-brainer. Using prophylaxis methods, you know, drench capsules, and drenches on a hill country sheep and beef farm, it's just not really on. So to me, the breeding way is the only way to go.
And how widely is it actually being used? Has it been used wide enough, or have we got a big opportunity there still within the ram breeding industry?
A huge opportunity. Not being involved directly in it anymore, I don't know what the numbers are, but I doubt that there's ever been more than 50, 60... breeders?
Yeah, around about 50 or 60. I mean, Neville Ames, who runs the RamGuard program, could tell us exactly how many people are actually using the RamGuard service. But I think as climate change goes ahead and as more rams are required for the industry, we really have to up our act as far as producing enough proven sires to deal with the problem.
So, as always with things in breeding, and you know, I've heard the same around selecting for worm resistance or tolerance, whichever way you're going. Is there a free lunch? What are the genetic or phenotypic correlations here? Are there, is it positively or negatively correlated with other production traits? If you select for this, are you going to reduce meat yield or anything?
Well, my experience of that, Aaron, has been that there's been no downside to it. I mean, in a humorous sense, I remember an early breeder who first got involved with this said that it was a great advantage to have a live sheep rather than a dead one. But that was, while it's humorous, it was actually very real. But now, moving forward into the here and now, we've got highly tolerant sheep, which are also highly productive in terms of all facets of their production. So, because in parallel to selecting for FE tolerance, breeders have also carried on selecting for three or four other main traits. So they've made parallel progress. So I don't think there's been any downside to it at all. And but Neil might have his own view on that, but to me it's been a win-win.
Yeah. Neil?
In the research flocks where there was selection only for FE and not for any other productive trait, I don't think there were any significant adverse effects. But one of the interesting positive effects was that facial eczema resistant sheep are more resistant to ryegrass staggers. Mm-hmm. And there's quite it's a significant association. And I think the reverse actually applies the other way around. You can actually select for ryegrass staggers resistance.
And indirectly.
It has, and that has an effect on. So probably what it's saying that there are some ways of handling toxins which selecting for one helps with the other particular toxin, sort of a general.
The other thing, ability. Aaron, if you look at the advanced central evaluation on Sheep Improvement Limited, and you know the families, and you're a bit of an enthusiast like I am, you can look at the families and the flock numbers, and you can see a theme coming through where the highly productive flocks are also tend to be highly FE tolerant. So to me, that's absolutely proof from a scientific point of view that the two things are working hand in hand.
And just on this breeding and tolerance, another thing, we had a good discussion over tea, is that, Neil, before you talked about the impact of clinical and subclinical impact on scanning percentage and lambing percentage, and we tend to see that across the industry in a bad year. We had a bad facial eczema year this last year, we've seen the lambing percentage drop. But it's quite possible for commercial farmers who haven't had a history of buying rams with facial eczema tolerance that they're actually having that every year. They might think 140% lambing is good, but it's been suppressed every year 5 to 8% from what it would be if they had a higher level of tolerance.
Yes, certainly.
There's a subclinical impact every year is what I'm sort of touching on.
In flocks which have been monitored and bled and to identify the subclinical liver damage, as the GET levels rise, the percentage of ewes that get pregnant, the scanning rate, that drops, the scanning rate drops, so the number of twins dropped, lambing falls off. So even in, as I said earlier, in a flock where 1% very moderate, minor clinicals, there was an 8% drop in potential lambing on scanning.
Just talking about that though, I mean, it basically involves dosing rams with a toxin, and which has issues in and of itself. Are there alternatives to that for identifying tolerant genetics?
Well, there's one method which we in the throes of developing a protocol, and I refer to it as the natural challenge. So one of the things I've been talking to farmers about, and we need to get a standardised protocol out for doing this, is that when you're breeding for tolerance and you go out and buy a group of FE tolerant rams and you breed from them and you end up with a cohort of hoggets, ewe hoggets to select from for your ewe hogget replacements, The question is, which ones of those daughters of those Fe tolerant rams are the ones you should keep for Fe tolerance? So one little method that we've been talking about is to use what I refer to as the natural challenge method, and that's whereby you identify that there's sufficient spore counts rise on your farm and in parts of your farm, and you put that cohort of animals on that pasture, take a blood test beforehand, and it needn't be such an expensive thing. I think if there was a bulk set of blood tests carried out, you can get it sub $5, under $5. Put them on the pasture for a period, and then 3 weeks later, take another blood test and assess the GGT levels using your vet. And that way you can either keep or eliminate animals that have a high or low GGT level as a method of fast-tracking your flock tolerance by looking at the cohort of ewe hoggets. You can do the same with a cohort of young rams. It's not as accurate because, as Neil's pointed out, you don't actually know what dose they're ingesting. But I think if you take a pre-test and a post-test and you see a rise in GGT levels or perhaps a decrease or stay the same, you can use it as a tool. It's better than a guess by a long shot. Yeah. But I'd be very interested in what Neil has to say about that.
Yeah.
Well, in the dim and distant past, the very first tolerance tests were actually run on toxic pasture, because in those distant days the Department of Agriculture was not commercial, and running commercial tests was not to be done and was frowned upon. So a protocol was developed for testing on toxic pasture, but for a breeder the problem basically is having the right toxic pasture every year. But for someone in a more general area who just wants to help move his ewe flock along with his maybe buying in rams, testing at the end of the breeding season, FE season, and keeping those which have low GGTs, getting rid of those with high GGTs, will certainly help move flock resistance, flock tolerance in the right direction. So it's a matter of the logistics and getting that organised. But yes, it's a valid technique.
So let's sort of draw a lot of this to the close. And look, we've just gone a wee bit over time, but there's a lot in this topic, and it's a big topic, and it's going to get bigger. So, you know, I wanted to cover this in some depth. On the breeding side of things, and Robert, I know you've got first-hand experience with this, so you can comment on it. Somebody's listened to this call, said, right, that's the way they're going. How fast can people actually make a significant difference in a commercial flock to the level of facial eczema tolerance they have?
Okay. Well, I can only talk about my experience. When we had that very bad year back in 1992, and we decided to, euthanize all the rams and buy a new cohort of FE-tolerant rams, cutting to the chase, within 5 years, we had a useful measure of tolerance within the flock. And that the evidence of that was that we were still having spore counts, were reasonably high on our farm, but we weren't seeing the clinicals, and also our lambing percentage started to go up in a meteoric fashion. I think the rule of thumb is that if you get out there and purchase the tolerant rams and get going on a breeding program, and you also apply some selection pressure to your replacement ewe hoggets, I think it's a 5 to 10 year commitment. But to me, it's worth the commitment because it takes a lot of worry off your shoulders. And also, not exactly a fine point, but it certainly adds dollars to your bottom line. So the price of a ram is money well spent, in my view. In fact, cheap as chips, really, when you consider the benefit of the genes that those rams have.
So, and just circling back a wee bit, we talked about the high heritability, the length of time people are doing it, and the levels of dosing they now are doing. you would actually expect to see some significant differences in a commercial plot, potentially faster than that, because the range you can buy must have a significantly higher level of tolerance.
Oh, look, I think that would be fair comment.
You were saying?
Yeah, I think so. I can't remember what levels people were testing it in those days, but I think it's probably around about 0.4, if I remember correctly. But we've got a few more tools, and as Neil alluded to, if we work on both the sire and the female progeny side of the equation, we can make faster progress because we're actually selecting the female replacements as well as just having the input from the sires. Because you've got to remember that not all the progeny will be tolerant. So if you can select the progeny which actually are tolerant and you're keeping them, it makes a lot of sense in terms of building that cohort of ewes up. You know, for standard flocks, you know, it's got two-tooths, four-tooths, five-year-olds, and even some six-year-olds. The sooner you've got the whole cohort of flock to a level of tolerance, the better, in my view.
Just, there's experimental work which just shows that if you take a group of tolerant rams, mate them to a group of naive ewes, their offspring will have a resistance which is about halfway between.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just that simple. But of course, you know, in 1 year, that's only part of your flock.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the level that you would get with the first year's offspring. You're halfway towards that particular breeder. Mm. So the higher the breeder is in the beginning, the better you're off.
Yeah.
And from there on, you just track along behind the breeder.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, as he goes up, if you keep buying rams from him, you'll just track up with him, but you'll be behind, of course.
Like, it's like the old story about buying rams. The first thing you must do is select the right breeder, and then if he's making genetic progress, you'll follow along behind and also make progress.
If he or she is making progress, right?
Yes, absolutely.
But anyway, look, we...
No names mentioned, but a good acknowledgement.
Look, we will... wrap up there. But just on that breeding thing, I mean, as a well-known agricultural scientist once said, it won't happen overnight, but it will happen, and you've got to start sooner or later. But from what the pair of you have been telling me tonight, it's as close almost to a free lunch as we get in sheep farming.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the nice things about the sheep farming journey is that we can help the other species in this, and that's one of the reasons that we formed the group. Because we certainly want to see the same levels of tolerance across the other species, and we know it's possible. So we're here to help them as well, because it's a New Zealand Inc. thing, I think. It's one of those unfortunate things that we have here in our livestock industry, and so we've got the proof that we know how to deal with it. We can deal with it. It's just going to take a little bit of time.
Thanks, Robert. All right, look, we have gone over time, but I think there were good reasons for that, and there was some good material there that I wanted to make sure we addressed. So, but I will pull it to a close now. Many thanks to you out there, the listeners, who've dialed in and sent your questions or are listening to this on the podcast. All that we've talked about tonight has just been revised and updated in Beef and Lamb New Zealand's Facing Up to Facial Eczema book, which you can get a copy of online on our website, or a hard copy free from us. For those of you that have been registered, we'll send out details about how to get a copy of that. The recording will be up on the podcast channel very soon, hopefully by the end of the week, so you can listen again to the bits you took note of, or share it around your friends and colleagues. But finally, excuse me, a very large thank you to our guest tonight, Robert Carter from Waitomo.
King Country, King my Country. Friend.
It's all the same to me, Robert, where I come from. And Neil Towers, who's based here in Hamilton. So thank you, gentlemen. Thank you all out there. And good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
You are about to end this.